You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Today's podcast is with Sarah Rule, and we welcome her back to the podcast. She's a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, a Tony Award nominee, and the recipient of the MacArthur Genius Fellowship. And she has a new book. It's called Lessons from My Teachers. You'll enjoy the pod.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Sarah Wool, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
I finished this book last Thursday night at my desk at Second City. It was actually opening night for our new main stage review. And my wife, Anne, couldn't be there because she was teaching a class at Northwestern. And I was having such an emotional reaction to the essays, in part because your world and my world have so much overlap.
Yeah.
Teaching the theater, growing up in the North Shore in the suburbs of Chicago. And then I got to this quote from the book, quote, "There is a natural and time-tested cure for loneliness that has existed for over 2,000 years, the theater. Given two joint crises, the loneliness epidemic and the economic implosion of the theater, I would like to offer a modest proposal. This is actually no joke. Why not give emergency funding to our theaters from the public health coffers? We would treat theater as a proven method to stem the tide of crippling isolation in this country. Theater treats the malady of loneliness and the malady of not being able to be fully present." End quote. That's a profoundly great idea. That will never happen.
Well, certainly not at the moment.
No, I mean, not at the moment.
Maybe if we had a different administration, it could have happened. But I truly believe that it's medicine. I think theater is medicine for loneliness and for the malady of not being able to be present. So, maybe at some point when the NIH replenishes itself, we can go back there.
Yeah, let's hope. I mean, that's such a thing. Of course, in theater and specifically in improvisation, right? This need to be fiercely in the moment, but you're doing it with a big group of people, right? Both potentially on stage and you know in the audience, and that kind of, I would say, like improv is yoga for your social skills, because it really teaches you this way of connecting in the moment. That yoga, when you're by yourself, you're so inwardly focused, but in improv, you have to be both sort of self-regulated, but then in communion with both your partner across from you and connecting with the audience, which is responding to what you're doing.
Yes. And speaking of being present, do you mind if I shut my windows? Because there's loud planes right now.
Please go ahead.
Sorry, one second. Also trying to put my focus mode on my stupid phone, and I'm having trouble doing it.
I'm leaving all this in.
Okay.
Just so you know, it's too good.
Yeah, maybe that will work. Why do they make it so complicated?
Well, as I told you, I'm recording from home because we got a new puppy. So I had to, and I live right next to the L tracks, even though they're on the ground where they come to me. So I had to close the sort of, it's a beautiful day here in Chicago. It's going to be almost 80 degrees.
It's beautiful here too. Okay, sorry. Do you mind just repeating the last second? I love what you said about yoga.
Improv is yoga for your social skills. So this idea of, you know, being present amidst the noise, because that's how life is.
Yeah, that's right. And I increasingly think that actors will be these strange avatars who are some of the few people who know how to be present. because they are able to react in real time without digital distraction for 2 hour stretches. And what person can say that about themselves anymore? I mean, it's really insane.
So I speak at a lot of like future of work conferences. So Everyone's asking me about AI, and I'm very interested in it, and I've been exploring it. But also, I'm also completely aware that there's, of course, of this dark side to it. And you actually write in the book early in the introduction, you say, quote, our phones can give us facts, but not story, information, but not relation. And so I think it's like, as we know that this technology will exist, we have to amp up the other side.
Right.
And that's the storyteller side, right?
Right. Yeah, it's all fascinating. My husband, for Mother's Day, thought it would be funny or interesting to put in some prompts to AI to write a poem for me. And he had AI do it in my style and mention all my children and my dog. And, you know, it wasn't bad. The poem wasn't bad. And so then you think, okay, so has the collective unconscious just become more available digitally? I mean, is there any positive way to view this in terms of access to the kind of collective mythic mind and all that humanity has known stretching back to the beginning? Because my first impulse is really terror. But I love what you say about, you know, as these other modes become available, how can we amp up the other side so that we're not, our other muscles aren't atrophying. But I see it so much with my kids too, you know, that other social muscles just start atrophying the more that we're on these devices.
Yeah. And I think you and I grew up at a time, I mean, we didn't have any of these things, right? I mean, I'm trying to think how many channels there were, like six.
Yeah.
So, something like that. That was it on a TV in which I was not sitting in front of all the time. And one of your first pieces is what your mom taught you. And you say, quote, if I had to choose between all the lessons she has taught me and hold one holy, it is this, to live in the moment, end quote. That's it, right? And so how did she teach you that?
My mom, who is an actress in Chicago, is just a very in the moment kind of person, just temperamentally. And maybe her life as an actor has trained that muscle. She is a wonderful conversationalist because she's full of boundless curiosity and really listens and really reacts in the moment. I don't know how she became that way, but she is that way. I mean, she used to, you know, bound down the stairs quoting Ionesco speeches, and and she is very playful. And so I just was lucky to grow up in a playful household where people liked hanging out. Like, remember hanging out?
With zero, like, you didn't plan ahead. The point was, oh, we're going to get together and then we're going to figure it out. I don't think anyone does that anymore.
No one does that anymore.
I want to talk about some of your early childhood teachers. And you had an elementary school art teacher who gave you an assignment you hated.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he wanted us to, first he just told us to make a beautiful drawing. So I was with my Crayola crayons and I made my drawing. And then he told us to paint black over it because he had this idea that we would be making these abstract designs where the color would show through the black. So we would like take a, like a safety pin and like sketch something out. And I didn't want to because I liked my drawing and I didn't want to paint black over it. And what's strange is I don't remember what happened. I don't remember if I refused. I don't think at that time in life I could have refused. Did Mr. Pollock himself paint black over it? I just revealed his name.
You just revealed his name. Do we know if he's still alive?
I don't know, but he was fairly old at the time.
Yeah, he's not.
I doubt he's still.
Yeah, we're okay. That is a. I mean, that I have seen that exercise happen with adults mm-hmm. in terms of this. I think it was an IDEO session I went to mm-hmm. where it was sort of teaching you to let go. And I understood that as an adult, but to do that to a child feels cruel to me.
And I look at it now and I think, oh, that's a really interesting assignment. And maybe it's that he didn't give us a heads up ahead of time that we would be painting over our drawings, or maybe I was overly attached to what I produced. So maybe looking back, it was a great assignment and I was too young to have cultivated non-attachment.
All right. I'm no, absolutely not. Because I think for children, you want to create the space where they play and things are pretty and things are nice. There is enough that we're going to have to deal with in terms of the non-attachment stuff later on. That's really, really difficult.
Well, and let's face it, he wasn't the kind of teacher who was interested in non-attachment.
Right.
He used to just scream at us, "Don't pound the paper." I remember that was his big mantra. And looking back, why would we have been pounding the paper?
Right.
I don't know. I suppose my point in including it in the book was that it's not only good teachers who teach you things, it's also your response to teachers who are, I'm not going to say bad teachers, because I don't think, you know, I don't believe in that kind of binary, but teachers who don't open you up, who mm-hmm. don't help you unleash your impulses, you know, that sometimes you have to be your own teacher when you're interfacing with a teacher who's shutting you down.
Right. And the book is, we'll get to some of these, because the book is very much about, it's not just the teachers that, you know, were amazing to you, it's the lessons you learned from other teachers that maybe were more difficult. The opposite, though, of this one is Principal Nilsson.
Mm.
That's a lovely story. You were that kind of scared of this guy, right, at first?
I was scared of this principal. He had a really booming voice. He was kind of a big guy. And I got in trouble in a school food fight, and I thought I was a complete innocent, but F.J. Phillips had thrown a French fry at me, and I threw it back at him. Mm-hmm. And I was called in, like, with all of the kind of the prime movers in the food fight, and we're all marched down to Principal Nielsen's office. And for some reason, he started the interrogation with me and was like, "Did you throw food at the food fight?" And I started to kind of explain myself and say, "Oh, yes, but not much," or "just one French fry." And he said, "I didn't ask you what you threw. I just asked, did you throw food at the food fight?" And I said, "Yes," and was sort of tearful and looked down at my shoes. And then F.J. Phillips defended me and said, "Oh, she really didn't do anything. Like, she didn't start it." And so I kind of got let off, but I do think someone told my mom about it. Mm-hmm. And so I'd been always a little frightened of him, and I'd always associated him with the injustice of authority figures who were kind of black and white and didn't listen to narrative. And then I heard this extraordinary story years later, after he died, about a little boy who had come to a central school in Wilmette, who was one of the first, or who was the first kid with HIV to be in that school system. And it had been not long after Ryan White in Indiana wasn't allowed to go to school, or there was a huge blowback from the community. And Professor Nielsen showed incredible leadership at the school in terms of welcoming the child, not telling parents the identity of the child, not even telling other teachers the identity of the child unless they were the ones caring for him in their classroom. And he really showed incredible heroic leadership. And so one of my lessons from Mr. Nielsen is that the figures we think of as scary, or we think of with our child's mind in a certain kind of way, are sometimes much more dimensional and sometimes really quietly heroic.
That's beautiful. My second guitar teacher had a huge impact on me. It was at the Old Town School of Folk Music, right where Piven was on Noy Street in Evanston.
Yeah.
I remember I'd never heard of teenage angst, and And clearly I was going through that. So he would always talk to me about my teenage angst. He goes, here's how we're going to get out your teenage angst. And it's just, it stuck with me all these years. And you had a piano teacher, Mrs. Rubenstein. And I love this. You say that she taught you how to make a mistake in music and keep going forward.
Mm.
And that is a beautiful lesson to have early in childhood.
It's an incredible lesson, and I see it with my own kids playing instruments now. I mean, the impulse I had when I made a mistake in music was to stop and start over again, stop and start over until I got it right. And she would teach us how to move through the mistake, especially in performance, to move through the mistake. And what an incredible lesson. I mean, I see it with students now. I call it Penelope syndrome sometimes, when they can't finish and they undo their work because of a perceived mistake. I call it Penelope syndrome just because of Penelope in the Odyssey unweaving what she weaves every night. But of course, she was doing that purposely. But I see students who are perfectionists do that sort of not purposely, but you know, they'll write, they'll get to a point, they'll stop, they'll judge themselves, and then they'll start over again. And that just keeps happening instead of pushing through the area of difficulty or the area of where they're judging themselves. And I do think that's where improvisation comes in too, as a technique that, you know, you keep going forward, you keep playing.
Yeah. You actually use the mistake, and the mistake is often an opening, right? You're like, oh, let's see where that takes us. And the audience is just there for it. That is their favorite. Yeah. And if you recognize that, your whole orientation shifts, because the opposite is self-sabotage.
Yes. That's right.
And that's, I mean, you can see how people do that in life in a number of different ways, where it's like, well, I'm just not going to do it. And you're like, this is where the good stuff is. I mean, it gets, because like, there is no perfection. Zero. You know, I love the way you talk about your marriage too, and being married in the book too, because there's just this lovely reality behind assembling our mutual flaws and deciding that they're okay for us to like move forward with. And that's just so many people don't approach things that way.
That's such a beautiful way of putting it. Assembling our mutual flaws. Marriage is an assemblage, a collage of our mutual flaws. It's really true.
Yeah. All right. My favorite bookstore in the North Shore was Bookman's Alley.
Yes.
Sadly, no longer there.
No.
Yeah. But I did find my way to the Wilmette bookstore many, many times. And
you
as
did.
You know, yeah. And as you know, unique. And that just sold one thing.
Yeah. Wait, where did you grow up exactly?
I was Kenilworth, right by the train station.
Oh my God. Near Homer's?
Yeah, near Homer's, walking distance from Homer's. Sure.
Oh my God, amazing.
Yeah.
And I've stayed loyal to Bookman's Alley in the sense that it's now Bookends and Beginnings. And I, you know, still love and support them.
Mm-hmm. Good.
But yeah, that was an incredibly unique bookstore. Yeah, Joan and Barbara's bookstore in Wilmette was so tiny and cozy and just full of stacks of books. And I was looking back at my experience of their bookstore and thinking how unusual it is that I was known to them. You know, it was so tiny that they knew me as a reader from a young age, and they would reach up and pick a book out that they thought I might like. And the experience was so different from, you know, my kids going into a big Barnes and Noble where there's like, you know, there's books, but there's tons of merch, particularly for kids that beguile the eye. So the idea of having a book handpicked for you by a person who knows you just seems kind of miraculous now.
Hmm. All right. I want to talk about Joyce Piven. I knew Joyce and Byrne. Stephen Colbert worked at the Blind Faith Cafe, and Byrne
did.
Oh, totally. And so he does an incredible impression of Byrne Piven ordering food.
Oh my God! How have I not known this?
Oh yeah, yeah. So I got to get him to do the impression for me. I'll send it to you because it's
would
like,
you please, or can you do it?
I can't. I cannot equal Colbert in this. But it was something about like a vegan omelet, but we're talking, you know, Byrne in the bellowing voice.
The voice, amazing.
So talk a bit about, for people who don't know, what I'll say about Joyce, her importance for Second City and Chicago theater more broadly. Joyce and her husband, Byrne, were members of the Playwright Theaters Club, as well as the Compass Players, which were the predecessors of the Second City. Playwrights being the first, basically, off-loop theater to do plays. Like that, it wasn't like touring Broadway shows. And the Compass Players being the first improvisational theater ever in America, that was really morphed into the Second City. So, but she was a mom of the whole theater community, and I know we talked about this before, and you studied with her.
I was very close to Joyce, and so sad when she died this year. You know, I've been rereading her book in the studio with Joyce Piven. I think it's a great book for people who don't know much about her, but who want to see her approach to the games and how Sills and Spolin affected her. But I grew up, you know, studying improvisation at the Piven Theater Workshop. I would have met Joyce a little later because, I met her when I was quite young, when I was 12 or something. And I remember her demonstrating the art of transformation, sort of transforming into a crone. But I didn't study with her until high school. I took scene study with her. She, you know, witnessed my first kiss unwittingly because it was in a scene study class. And then when it was clear I was no actor, it was clear to me, and became a playwright, she was so supportive and commissioned my first professional commission, which was Orlando. She staged that in Chicago and then LA. And then we just became really close friends and collaborators. And we had kind of a little triumvirate. It would be me and Polly Noonan and Joyce sharing meals, or sometimes Jessica Thebus would be folded into that. Just a lifelong conversation about theater and books and being a human being and balancing motherhood and theater. And she was a force of nature. And the last time I visited her, she still wanted to talk about books. She wanted to talk about her upbringing on the South Side of Chicago, where she said that her father was a ne'er-do-well, but he was a good storyteller. And she credits him with teaching her how to tell a good story. And she says that's what got her out of poverty in her mind. I'm just an extraordinary woman and fierce and generous and so specific about the work.
I think the best teachers in the improv field, they have to focus so much on listening, but they themselves model it, because it's a kind of listening that you don't experience on a day-to-day level. And I think that's where the transformation starts.
I agree. And I remember Joyce saying, you know, the most beautiful thing on stage is someone really listening. Just say, not acting like they're listening, not performing listening, but listening. And when you are listening, you're not planning what to say next. You're not rehearsing your next line. You are listening. And that is what she modeled. And you speak to someone differently when they're really deeply listening like that.
And I think one of the things, I talk about this a lot, is when you're listening deeply, you're listening to the last word that's said. And we have exercises where you actually have to do that, because your response is going to be the last word they said. So you really have to do that. And that also means that you can't be preparing to say what you're going to say. But what people fail to understand is that they think it's going to be awkward. It's like, it's the opposite. If you're really pausing, and I know you've heard everything, and you're thinking about how you want to respond, I love that. I feel seen. And so it's like, everyone can slow down. Like, you can take 2-3 beats. It will be fine. But we've been conditioned almost, certainly culturally, but in our moment to moment interactions, that we don't do that. And it's to our detriment, in terms of actually understanding what's being said inside a conversation.
Absolutely. And I think Joyce was someone who was probably impatient with small talk for that reason. When she was, dying, she had pneumonia, and Shira, her daughter, was very generous, you know, fielding phone calls and visitors. And so I called Joyce, and Shira held the phone up, and Joyce couldn't speak, but I was able to read some poetry to her And I read her some lines from The Tempest, Full Fathom Five, My Father Lies, that section about that was coral, that was his eyes. And it goes into talking about a transformation rich and strange. And Joyce used to have us take that section and kind of explore and heighten it in classes. And I wanted to read it to her because I felt like she was about to undergo this profound transformation. And you could imagine it feeling awkward to read a poem to someone when they couldn't respond. But because I was so used to Joyce's listening and the quality of her listening, I just felt like she was right there.
Since we last spoke, my son, our son Nick, moved to Atlanta, and he's an associate with the Atlanta Shakespeare Theater, and he's actually touring the educational program. He's doing Tempest. And so for like little kids at libraries around Georgia, and he loves it. And the kids do too, which is great. It's great to sort of see that tradition being upheld. And that Shakespeare Theater in Atlanta too is so unusual, because Ann and I have been there a few times to see Nick perform, and the audience is everyone.
Yeah.
It is black and white. It is old and young. It's guys who look like they're roadies for the Allman Brothers, next to a business person, next to artsy theater people. And we don't get that in Chicago, that kind of audience.
Don't get that in New York either. I think it's really healthy, and I think that's how theater started out. And I don't know how it got so siloed, but it has.
Money.
Yes. Capitalism.
It's capitalism again.
Oh, yes.
It's all Milton Friedman's fault. Yes. All right. I do want to talk about Lessons from a Marriage. You write in that piece, quote, "I think an equal marriage is many things to many people, but for me, equal parenting is when you worry the same amount, but on different days."
Mm.
Perfect. Absolutely. Because you got to pick up. You got to pick up for the other one, and you got to trust that they're going to pick up as well. And when you do that, it works.
Yeah. It's an enormous seesaw. And I mean, I have friends in marriages where it's kind of gendered, and they don't think it's gendered, but the husband doesn't really pick up the slack in terms of that kind of logistical mental planning that takes up so much of your brain space. And I just got really lucky that Tony, my husband, is very willing to let all those details enter his brain space. And I think, you know, at times he probably finds me totally irritating as an Aquarius who's thinking about other things half the time, you know, and that he does have that stage manager brain, and I don't. Mm-mm. So yeah, it's, I partly lucked into it. So I feel bad bragging about it, because, you know, it's not like you can decide, well, I don't know. Maybe you can decide. Maybe we can all train ourselves to be better at these things. But I do think things are changing.
I know for us, we've talked about this, my wife and I, which is like, I wasn't great about this when we were early in our career, and with she was always the one to go get the kids. And then when our daughter Nora got sick, that's when I changed. And I hate that it was that reason, but it and my son has actually said this to me too. He's like, "Yo, God, you're such a better parent now than you were before." Mm. And I, you know, it shouldn't take, you know, a tragedy to do that. Yeah. But also sometimes you do have to get sort of shocked into like, okay, this is just it's different, and it has to be different. But also the world sort of what helps you with that too, when they understand you're going through something. So it's like, how do we make that a norm? How do we? And it also starts with the fact that we have to acknowledge the caregiving, the fact that we don't pay our caregivers is nuts. It's in no way does this make any sense. That how do you expect these children to be raised?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry, and second, I think that's true that emergencies cause us to change. And I mean, for us, in a way, the emergency was going from one kid to three very rapidly when I had twins. I think when we only had one child, Anna, I think we had a more traditional structure, and Tony's a doctor, and mm-hmm. He didn't perceive that his work was changeable, whereas mine could be more interruptible. Mm-hmm. And so I did probably most of all of the picking up and doctor's appointments and stuff when she was little. And then when we went from one to three, and I kind of lost my shit.
That happens.
And I had a lot of illness issues I was going through too. Interestingly, mm-hmm. Tony realized that a profound shift needed to take place.
Mm. All right. I want to talk about a couple more of these pieces and then ask you for a thank you because story. Your first review was also your first bad review.
Yes.
That's not fun.
That's all right.
Now, is that the same critic that you then had, like, you broke bread with later?
Yes.
Was it Jack Helbig?
I can't say. I cannot reveal.
Jack died. So if it's him, you can. You already outed the teacher.
Well, maybe it wasn't Jack then.
No, I guess it isn't, because I think you actually would have said so. So what did you talk about that? Because, I mean, so we just opened the show, this new Main Stage show. It's fantastic. And I'm maybe the biggest critic of Second City shows. And I just wouldn't say anything if it wasn't good. But, like, on the record, this is, like, in my top 20 shows. And it's getting great reviews. It got one, the review that sort of mattered, that's the sort of prominent critic in town, my friend, you know, didn't appreciate it. I'm at a place now where, like, it doesn't matter, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We're going to sell just as many tickets. It's like, people are going to go and enjoy it. But for a lot of other people, they can't let go of getting that review that they didn't want. And I just think you go crazy as an artist if you tie your happiness, your contentment, or your self-worth or value to some critic's review.
I totally agree. And yet it's so hard to parse and move on. And I mean, we talked about capitalism briefly, but there is a sense in which the worth of a show or a play, a new play, gets tied to, particularly in New York, the New York Times. I mean,
yeah.
If you have a new play and the New York Times doesn't like it, that determines the play's entire future from that, you know, either it goes on to have a life or it doesn't, and it stops there. So it does have a profound effect. So to really be clear about why you're doing what you're doing and to have some sense of intrinsic worth about it, despite how it's being made into story by experts publicly, it's very hard. And I think I was lucky because I got some really good reviews early on in New York that helped me make a career. And then there was a sort of decade of, I don't know, less good luck with critics. And it was really painful and hard for me to navigate. You know, Joyce was really great about that with me. And, you know, I would call her for advice. But it's painful for an artist. You have to have thin skin.
Yeah.
To make your art, and you have to have thick skin to make your art. So,
what was the play that kind of took you out of that decade? What was the critically well received piece that?
Well, The Clean House was my first big show in New York at Lincoln Center.
Yeah,
and it was really well received. So that, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you've had such a career, right? And you've tackled different genres, and the Eurydice that was done at Writers here, when we loved it so much, and we called our son actually on the drive home to just talk about it. And that's always the best, because it's a long drive, right? Because that's in Glencoe. We're up near Lincoln Square. So we talked for 45 minutes, and it's like, that's what you want the theater to be. It's like the drive home, the conversation. That's always been, my dad reviewed theater for WGN, and I remember going, you know, home with him after shows and having those conversations, and it's such a gift.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So what I'm curious about too, and I don't remember if we talked about this before, but I remember during COVID, and this is weird because, again, I'm doing this podcast from home, which I haven't done literally since COVID. Mm. And I remember saying to someone, I think I was being interviewed, I said, that here's the one thing about, I have lived by a credo my entire life in theater, that the show must go on.
Mm-hmm.
That was blown to hell mm-hmm. with COVID.
Yeah.
And that was a fundamental truth of our work that I don't know what blinders we had on, but it was used often. I'm not going to say totally because I think there's aspects of it that are cool, but it was often used as a way to make people who didn't have much money work when they're sick.
Yes.
And that's effed up.
Completely. And things have changed post COVID. It's interesting thinking about that because we're doing Eurydice now at the Signature Theater and our Orpheus got pneumonia and Signature doesn't have understudies. So there was a whole week where we were missing our Orpheus. And at a point I said, we need an understudy. Like literally Maya Hawk, who's playing Eurydice, was rehearsing with her dog one day, like not on purpose, but like she'd brought her dog to work and her dog ambled into the scene with her and Orpheus and the stage manager was reading in. I was like, oh my God, she's acting with her dog. Like we need an understudy. And so Kenny from the Writers Theater production who played mm-hmm. Orpheus, I remembered him being really transcendent and incredible. He flew out, he knew the role. So he, one day was in on a vegetable farm in Wisconsin. The next day he was in New York, wow. reading in for Orpheus, which was incredible. But, you know, the ethos of the theater was much more like to Caleb was like, stay home till you're better, you know, rest, like don't come in until you're ready to come in. And 3 years ago, it would have been like, you can have like 2 days.
That's it. And get in there.
That's it, you know? So things really have changed, and yet the economics are worse than they ever have been. So mm-hmm. it's a real pickle, I think, yeah. for the theaters.
Here's the other thing. This is the tougher conversation, which is, and it's a both things are true, I think, conversation, which is, this was used in a way that's very unhealthy and not good and not ethical, I don't think. At the same time, we also have, my wife sees this as a teacher, especially in college, that we have a time where, because of COVID and other things, you have generations of young people who don't want to be uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
And you've got, this is the tough part of the conversation, which is what is a boundary and what is a risk, you know, mm-hmm. and that's a tough tension because like, no, like the uncomfortable stuff is the good stuff. That's where you're going to find that. And absolutely you should have boundaries that are respected, but exploration requires a kind of like tough vulnerability to try stuff. And sometimes that stuff's not going to go well.
Yeah, and I do find that teaching as well, that COVID has made it much more complicated. And what students ask of themselves and what you can ask of students, it's just really complicated terrain right now, I think.
Do you think, because Paula Vogel was your mentor, and it struck the way you write about her, it struck me that she could teach you well because of her sort of fierce presence there with you, that you were willingly sort of taking the hand and explore. Is that the way you get to the kids in the classroom? Is just model the behavior as best you can?
Maybe that's it. I mean, Paula, you know, she's taught a generation of playwrights, and part of it is her fierce love of this, of the subject matter and the content that she would transmit. And part of it was just modeling how to live a life, and this life of incredible bravery and generosity, and this desire to pull you along for the health of the field. It's extraordinary. I don't know anyone like her.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. This is a perfect setup for our last question. So for returning guests who answered our sort of yes and story, we asked for a thank you because story, a time when you didn't really want a yes and, but you did by sort of calling on your gratitude. Do you have a story for us around that?
I do. I talked a little bit about, you know, illness. And so after I gave birth to my twins, I had paralysis on the left side of my face, and it just kept going on and on and on. For most people, it goes away. And it turned out, years later, I found out that it was Lyme disease, untreated. And it actually took a book, writing a book to get a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And I, one of my neurologist friends, Julie Roth, I asked her for advice at a point, you know, like, what do you say to patients when they're dealing with a really difficult chronic illness that's not getting better? And she talked about giving gratitude journals to them. And she said, when I ask patients with living with really difficult neurological problems to write about their gratitude, I tell them to be really specific, like that it's not enough to say, like, I'm grateful for my friends and family, you know, the kind of thing you say on Thanksgiving, which is true. I mean, that is very true. But to be, she said, be really specific. So like I would write a list of, like, I'm grateful that my toes work, you know, something like that. Because imagine if your toes didn't work, it would be really annoying. Or like, I'm grateful that I can blink with my left eye now, because for a while I couldn't blink, and that was really annoying when I would be in the bright sunlight, or if I was putting a shirt on and it might scratch my eye. Like, I'm grateful that my babies can sleep through the night now, or I'm grateful that I have a head of hair. You know, things that we take for granted, but when you imagine the loss of those things, they're devastating. Just like, you know, you don't think on a day-to-day basis, I'm grateful that I can smile. Mm-hmm. But when I couldn't smile, the loss of it was devastating.
Yeah.
So thinking of all of these other things in my life that were working well, in fact, you know, and enumerating them was a really good practice.
I love it. The book is called Lessons from My Teachers. Sarah Rule, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's so nice to see you. Such a delight.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox The Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Survives. Ooh.
survive.